Hey everybody, Adam Sharkov here, your host of FilmWax Radio, and this is episode number 466 of the podcast. On this episode, we have two segments. We have a young filmmaker named Joseph Lingad, who has a Kickstarter campaign in full thrust, and he is trying to raise money for this very, very, I think, really worthwhile and powerful project. And we're going to have him on. Then we're going to have on the author of a book called On Sunset Boulevard, The Life and Times of Billy Wilder. Ed Sykov is on the podcast. You know, the book has been a big bestseller. It's been out for quite a while. He recently re-released it with a new afterword, which was included his meeting Billy Wilder, which was well after the book came out, and they put out a new edition not long ago. And so anyway, that was enough for me to read the book and to say, let me get this guy on the show. So we'll get to all that. Well, last night was the 90th Oscar ceremony, and The Shape of Water won Best Film. You know, it's interesting because in the case of an award show this big, really, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it matters to the film and to the filmmakers who wins, but in a sense, you know, the nominated films are all the big ones. I mean, they truly are winners. So whoever wins you know, you're talking about such a slim margin, probably, in many cases, of like why a particular film won. The Shape of Water was the big winner in the sense that it won both Best Picture and Best Director, but at the same time, it could have just as easily been I, Tonya. It could have been Darkest Hour. It could have been Three Billboards. You know, it's what I liked about this year, ceremony aside, just thinking over all the different films that were nominated and that rose to the top, is that other than, let's say, Dunkirk and Blade Runner 2049, both of which were these big spectacles in the old Hollywood tradition and with enormous budgets and, of course, relying heavily on special effects. You know, most of the films were very, very story-oriented or character-oriented. Not that they were necessarily independent films, but that they were in that, I think, tradition. And even Darkest Hour, which was certainly a big film, felt very small in terms of how much it was a character study on Churchill and the performance that Gary Oldman gave. So I really kind of like this year. I actually expected Dunkirk was going to probably win all the major awards because it's sort of Hollywood paying homage to itself. But I guess things really have taken in the terms of changes, finally. Because only, I think, a few years ago, Dunkirk would have swept the Oscars. The fact that it didn't this year, that a movie like The Shape of Water did, speaks volumes. In the past, you know, you have to remember, Hollywood was interested in major movie star vehicles, usually big budget epics, Gladiator, Dances with Wolves, you know, stories that were big and sweeping like that. And I think the fact that I, Tonya and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri were big winners does really speak to the changes in Hollywood. It's just my perspective. And that Frances McDormand won Best Actress, terrific. Gary Oldman winning Best Actor. Supporting actors, I had predicted Allison Janney. At the moment I walked out of I, Tonya, I knew she was the winner. Sam Rockwell, yeah, I guess he did a great job. I mean, he was one of the reasons I really liked Three Billboards, but I could have just as easily have seen another actor win that award. You know, when it came to the documentary categories, a little disappointed just that none of my friends won any awards. Also, Tatiana Riegel, who was on this podcast for Best Editor, she got cheated. You know, it was I was disappointed that none of my guests ended up winning, but that's a very selfish perspective, I guess, that the editing award did go to the editor of Dunkirk, and the documentary feature went to a very worthwhile and important documentary, Icarus. When I saw Icarus, I knew that it was a really important film. You know, I was kind of rooting for Strong Island, but again, as I said at the top of the show, these are all winners. And when it came to the short, two of my friends that have been on this podcast were nominated in either one. But I did watch, just before I started this recording right now, I watched Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405. It's directed by a filmmaker named Frank Stifel. I mean, I may have pronounced it wrong. It might be Stifel, but I think it's Fred Stifel. And on the subject of mental illness, and it's really was quite worthy of an Oscar. It's a beautiful and moving film. You can find it, by the way, on YouTube. A very nice high-def copy of that. is there, and I recommend you spend a few minutes watching this exceptional short film. So, you know, I don't really care so much about the ceremony. I feel like I'm more interested in, you know, I just sort of sit through it. And I think Jimmy Kimmel certainly did a acceptable job. But I don't look at it as any particular memorable occasion. There was obviously a lot of focus on Me Too and Time's Up moments. And I thought, you know, or certainly a major highlight was Frances McDormand's speech. You know, but otherwise, it's Hollywood. It's usually very self-congratulatory. I don't see this particular year as being very different. But it's Hollywood's biggest night. So why should they rock the boat too much? Anyway, that's the Oscar wrap-up in my own awkward, stumbling manner. We got, again, two segments coming up here. We have first here, this is my conversation with Ed Sykov, who wrote this wonderful book. Again, it's called On Sunset Boulevard. Now, this is a real scholar of the American cinema. In addition to Billy Wilder, Ed has written biographies of Peter Sellers, Betty Davis, and a number of other books on Hollywood. I haven't read them, but I'm going to eventually. I mean, he's such a good writer. And this On Sunset Boulevard is a really extraordinarily well-prepared author doing great work. And so he was a terrific guest on the show. Ed does, by the way, have Parkinson's. I only mention it because you will hear it in our conversation. It's unavoidable. And I just thought I'd let you know, why not mention it? And then he had no problem with me mentioning it. I went over to his home. Thank you, Ed, for inviting me in Manhattan. And this is where we did this. And we'll be back after that with my friend Joseph Lingad regarding a new project of which he's trying to raise money right now. But in the meantime, here is, on the subject of Billy Wilder, author Ed Sykov on the podcast Filmwax Radio. Well, this is how I start shows, mid-conversation, because it's just smoother, so we've already begun. Well, let's start with a little bit of going back, Ed, because I think this is your second or third book, at least.
I've written seven.
Seven books. See, there's a case. You just corrected me.
Yeah.
But I guess the movie biographies I was looking at.
It was my first biography. I've written two subsequently.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, one on Peter Sellers and one on Betty Davis.
Okay, very good. All three are so different from one another.
They were, except that the one thing that I realized after writing them all was that each one of them was driven to work more than the average person. You know, they
you don't mean in a car. You mean like ambition-wise.
Driven, yeah. Driven like in you can't help yourself, right. But do work. And they were most themselves when they were working, and they were happiest when they were working.
Right. Well, that makes sense. So, and I guess that's bodes well of their partners and over the years, because that's a hard person to be with.
Yes, very difficult people.
Yeah, especially if you're conventional, domestic minded person, to have somebody who you're living with whose career is number one.
Right.
Especially in Hollywood, they're never going to be around. They're going to always be busy 7 days a week.
And, right. Well, Peter Sellers had four marriages, and Betty Davis had four marriages, and Billy Wilder had two.
Right. Yeah, I've noted that. But he had a lot of affairs, though, especially during the first marriage. Right. That's what we.
I believe so. Yeah.
Well, it's nice. I get to read other books of yours then.
Because this is good.
Because the one we're discussing today is called On Sunset Boulevard, The Life and Times Billy Wilder, directed by Ed Seikov. It's Seikov?
Yes.
Seikov. Mm-hmm. You sure you got that right?
I'm sure.
Okay. I guess you'd know. Well, it was a total pleasure to read. You know, it's a very thorough biography of Billy Wilder from soup to nuts. I mean, you got his whole life here. I may say that there's obviously a main focus on his work, mm-hmm. obviously, because as you already mentioned, his work was his life.
Yeah.
And his passion, and it identifies the man. But there's a lot to it also that in his early life, which was for me a really nice part of the book. Normally, I can't wait to get to the career, the identifiable, the more familiar movie titles, the Hollywood stories.
Sure, as one of my editors put it, when referring to the beginning of the book, the part that nobody reads.
Well, what about that? I never asked about that, but because the early years, we all can't wait to get through them. But in this case, it is in of itself a Hollywood story or a story worthy of a movie because it's just so incredible. I mean, and I also have an interest and a fascination with these Hollywood emigres who escaped fascist or Nazi Europe and lived and made their home in U.S. but worked in for Hollywood. There's so many,
right? Including a tremendous number of people left. Billy Wilder had the presence of mind to leave really early. He left just about as early as you could leave when there was a good reason to. You know, the Reichstag burned and he decided it was time to go. Mm-hmm. So
take your time.
He rolled up a few of his artworks and mm-hmm. took $1,000 or so and he was out of there. Mm-hmm. And he went to Paris. And which is where he made his first movie.
Oh, I forgot that part. See? Yeah. Because I have it like he was born in Poland, family moved to Austria, right?
Right, to Vienna.
To Vienna, specifically, where he started after he was, I guess, looking for a career, decided he was going to be a reporter.
Right.
In Vienna. And then did he start screenwriting in Vienna, or did he first move as a reporter to Berlin?
He was a reporter when he moved to Berlin, and then he started writing screenplays.
Mm-hmm. Right, in Berlin, and actually had a significant amount of success.
Yes, he was a rising young screenwriter when Hitler came to power, and it wasn't as if he was leaving nothing behind. He was leaving a life that he had begun to create for himself.
And his mother.
And, well, his mother was in Vienna. And his father as well.
Mm. So it's true that he was leaving. He could have stayed and been a huge success in Berlin had things turned out a little differently in those days. But he also had an advantage in that if there was a career in... I'm not saying that he could have predicted exactly how much success he would have ever had, but he did go to Hollywood where there at least was a career that he could evolve into since he was already making films.
Yes, but of course he didn't speak English.
There was that.
Yes, there was that. He had to learn English as he was writing the screenplays.
Amazing, right?
In English.
Yeah.
So, it was quite a feat.
A lot of motivation there.
A lot of motivation, yeah. Yeah, he was a highly motivated guy.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm. Who used to, he used to claim that he learned English from lyrics to jazz songs. He also claimed to have lived for a while in an antechamber of the ladies' room of the Chateau Marmont Hotel.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
One never knows.
That was a little dubious.
Yeah. His stories tend to be very colorful, but maybe not so true.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there were exaggerations where maybe he found himself sleeping there one night because of circumstances.
Right.
And then that
turned into a story.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like he had a certain amount of something of a charmed life, even though there was this tragic momentum that brought him to California, you mm-hmm. know, as a young man. But it didn't take it didn't sound like it took terribly long till he got enough English under his belt to start to get gigs.
No, he got work right away.
Yeah,
he was brought over by Eric Palmer, who is a big German producer, mm-hmm. and he saw a talent when he recognized Billy's talent early on. So he was willing to take the chance of hiring a writer who couldn't speak English to write an English language film.
Yeah.
It was quite remarkable.
Yeah, but he was a German himself, Palmer, as you're saying.
Yes.
Who were some of the other folks that came during that time? You know, I know that some of the other emigres included William Wyler, Fred Zinnemann, and Ernst Lubitsch was maybe a little slightly earlier, I'm guessing.
He came earlier.
A little earlier even. Maybe he didn't, wasn't, was he running from Nazi Germany? Or
No.
Sounds like he probably was out of there beforehand.
Yeah. He was making movies here for a while by the time Hitler came to power.
And there was
Peter Lorre.
Peter Lorre, who was an actor.
He was a friend of Billy's. They were friends in...
Here? They weren't friends in Berlin, though, right?
They were friends, I don't think in Berlin, but they lived in the same hotel in Paris when they moved.
Oh, right, right, right.
And Frederick Waxman, mm-hmm. Bachmann.
All their names kind of...
Composer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who would work with four... A billion number
in a number of cases, films. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they shared the same hotel.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
So they would sit around and commiserate because they had left their lives behind
and livelihoods.
And livelihoods, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. That hotel. They were staying in a hotel in Paris for a short time,
right.
During that transition, right? And it was full of a lot of transients, you can call them, right? Because there were many people were using that hotel as their stopgap,
right?
Before making onto whatever ship, transatlantic ship. What a time! But I'm fascinated by that whole period, or all those folks that came over, and there were so many other actors too, and people from the film world. Who was it? It was like one of the major stars, American stars of the day. I want to see somebody like. What's the actor? You'll know this. I don't have to worry about it. who is the wheelchair-ridden actor who played Mr. Potter? You once called me
Lionel Barrymore.
Lionel, thank you. It may not have been Lionel Barrymore. If somebody a stature was walking through the commissary, you've heard this anecdote, and said something like, you know, something to the fact that you're more German here than somewhere. I can't remember even the anecdote, so I don't know why I brought it up. But it just was the point being there was a lot of German being spoken,
yeah.
Or German accents in Hollywood at that time, right?
It was quite a Germanification of the American film industry.
But Billy Wilder assimilated really quick,
mm-hmm.
right? He really took to Hollywood. You obviously know a lot about Billy Wilder. How do you suppose, coming from that, it seemed as though you would be carrying around a lot of baggage, right? Metaphorically speaking, coming from that period and knowing that you've lost your family and all the people you knew, or a lot of the Jewish people you knew, certainly. And just what was happening, and then making these screwball comedies and making some of the most memorable comedies.
Right.
And even the dramatic films, they weren't weighted down. You know what I mean? There seemed to be something upbeat about his style in general.
Yeah. He was a very, very funny man, but he could also be very mean.
Yeah.
So... There is a real blend in his films of of humor and a kind of nasty quality. You know, he's mildly nasty, but it's still nasty. You really get the sense of somebody with an acerbic mind.
I remember, and interrupt me because, you know, I'll just talk. But here's an example, maybe. In one of his earliest directorial efforts, because he started, again, a great career as a screenwriter before he started directing, here, even in Hollywood, mm-hmm. most notably with his partner, Charles Brackett, right? But he wrote and directed A Foreign Affair, right? Which starred John Lund.
Right.
And Marlena Dietrich. Correct.
Right,
and he literally, she's a prostitute.
Jean Arthur,
and of course the great Jean Arthur. I believe if I had been in Hollywood in those days as an actor, I would have married Jean Arthur. I would have wanted Myrna Loy, but I would have ended up with Jean Arthur, right. Which is not a bad deal, by the way. I'm just saying. But anyway, so Marlena Dietrich is a prostitute, a German who lives in Berlin. And right, John Lund is sort of there's a whole sort of secret thing going on, but essentially he's having a relationship with Marlene Dietrich. At one point he it's meant as a joke, but he's like has his hands around her neck and is talking about strangling her,
right?
As a joke, as a kind of an affectionate joke.
Yeah. She's got a questionable Nazi-ish past,
which is Nazi-ish.
It's Nazi-ish. Which is never quite spelled out exactly, but she's been cozy with the Nazis, and now she's cozying up to the Americans in the form of John Lund.
Right.
There's a wonderful moment in the film where he's carrying a ratty old mattress that he has managed to acquire, and he's carrying it over to Marlena's apartment. And it's quite obviously a used mattress.
Oh yeah.
With all the attendant implications, and he's whistling "Isn't It Romantic," which is just hysterically funny when you think about it.
Yeah.
They tended to use "Isn't It Romantic" because Paramount owned the rights to the song, and so it appears quite often in Paramount films. But Wilder used it to.
Great effect.
To great effect. In that particular moment.
Yeah. I guess I was, you know, also just drawing an example of which we could probably find many in his films. And that, by the way, that that kind of... But that movie, A Foreign Affair, which I got to finally see for the first time just because I knew we were going to meet, and I watched everything mm-hmm. that I had missed and rewatched a lot of stuff, too, that it had just been so long since I had seen. But A Foreign Affair I had not seen before, so it was a gem, you know, it was like great. And that was shot during the war. It was still, you know, right, the Nazis were still in Europe.
It was after the war was over.
I thought it was like still like in the 40s or something. No.
It was.
Okay.
But the war ended Europe in theater 45. And
this was like 46, 47 or something?
I think it was filmed in 47 and released in 48.
Okay.
It was the second production that was allowed into Berlin to film. And the opening scenes where they're flying over bombed out Berlin, you see what the expression "bombed out Berlin" really means. The place is a wreck.
Yeah.
It's just miles and miles and miles of destroyed buildings.
Yeah. It's dramatic. Yeah. So maybe what I was thinking is that they were still lots of still questionable people in Berlin perhaps during that time. And maybe there were, I'm not sure if there were still trials going on but there were still plenty of Nazis still in Berlin, probably when they were making the film. It's possible.
Yeah, and Wilder had been sent over by the army to coordinate, among other things, to coordinate the production of a film about the concentration camps and the gas chambers, and he never did make the movie, which is ridiculous. They had him working on other things, which doesn't make much sense to take one of the world's great filmmakers and have him do other things. But I managed to talk to his driver, at that point in his life. The guy was in the army and was assigned to drive Mr. Wilder around. And he remembers being awestruck by an occasion where Wilder was they were at a party, and Billy was pointing out which ones were the Nazis and which ones weren't. And he knew the whole array of them because he'd been working in the industry there.
This is during when he was supposed to be doing the documentary, you mean?
Right.
Right, when he came back, sent by the government. And it was a government job. He was earning a government job, government wages.
Yeah.
Right?
He said at one point in his life that he'd been made a colonel, which is absolutely not true. He may have been billeted as a colonel, but he certainly was not a colonel. And rank is everything in the military, as the old expression has it. Mm-hmm. None of the papers that I found in the National Archive pertaining to him, his time in Germany, refers to him as corporal.
Right. Or any rank.
It's Mr.
Right?
Wilder. And yeah. and it's quite clear that he was not a colonel. He was not an officer.
Well, it was a government job, not a military job. Right.
Right.
Well, this is a good point as any to actually ask a couple of questions again about the book, because people can now order a copy, by the way, of On Sunset Boulevard. It's been revised, right? You did a revision a couple of years ago?
It's got a new epilogue.
Okay, a new epilogue. Anyway, so it's still, I discovered the book in a well-known book chain. Well, we could say Barnes & Noble. It was prominently displayed, I might add.
Oh, good.
On the table of right when you walk in, that's good placement, you know. Anyway, so tell me when you came up with the idea for the book, and then we'll come back to more Billy Wilder films and anecdotes. But I want to know a little bit more about you and the book. When did you decide to write a book, a biography of Billy Wilder? And what's the timeline around that? And when did the book come out originally? And
the book came out originally in 1998. And I started it in 1995, I believe. My agent, the marvelous Edward Hibbert, who's also an actor, mm-hmm. He used to be on Frasier as the obnoxious English food critic, Gil Chesterton.
Oh, very, very memorable.
Right. He's one of the funniest people I've ever known. But anyway, he took me out to lunch after a book that I'd written and said, what's next? What do you want to do? Biographies are selling well. So I thought, and I came up with some names, and he kind of yawned in my face. And he said, but who do you really want to write about? And I said, well, Billy Wilder, of course. I don't know why I hadn't suggested him at the beginning of the conversation. It took me a while to realize that he was the one person that I really wanted to write about, because I adored his movies, and I adored the stories that I had heard about him. And for the first and only time in my life, I actually saw a person's eyes turn into cash registers. And cha-ching.
Right.
And he said, we can sell that. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, it didn't take too long before it was sold on the basis of a proposal. So I started writing the book. And it's a big book. It's 675 pages. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I think it's my best book. I certainly felt more attached to him as a character, if you can call a living person a character. He would certainly be the person to rate the name character. But I felt very connected to him, mm-hmm. and knew that was the case when I began to have dreams about him, and he was approving
really?
of the project, although he wouldn't talk to me while I was writing the book. I kept sending him these nice little notes, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't respond.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, when did he pass away?
2002, I think.
Oh, okay.
But I did get to meet him after the book was published, which is what the epilogue is about.
Oh, great. Okay.
So yeah, that's quite a
right.
tale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was that a great experience?
It was the greatest day of my life.
Okay. Where did that? Tell me the circumstances around that.
the short version is that the German publisher named Benedikt Taschen, publishes art type books.
Yeah, I have several.
Yeah, they're beautiful books.
I have the 60s, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever. I have like right. five of them or so. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, the problem with Mr. Taschen is that he doesn't pay his writers very much. Mm. So he wanted me to write what turned out to be the Some Like It Hot book, a very large, very lavish book that celebrates the film, Some Like It Hot. And so he called and left a message on my machine one day and told me that to call him at a certain number, and I called him, and he flew me out to Los Angeles, and that which was very nice. And he lives in a very famous house on the side of the hill off of Mulholland Drive. It's a big concrete pole with an octagonal house sitting on the top of it. Hmm. It's been seen in The Simpsons and in Body Double.
Animation form. Okay, right.
But you have to take a funicular up to the house from the street. Anyway, I met him there and was blown away by this house. And then he said, "Okay, now let's go and meet Mr. Wilder at his office." So he gets into his car, and I get into my little rental car, and he starts down Mulholland Drive like it was the Autobahn. And I was panicking. I was just drenched with sweat and terrified that the next day's LA Times would read, "Millionaire publisher dies in fiery crash," blah, 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 blah. And then at the bottom it would say, "Writer also dies."
Yeah, right, as a footnote. And you don't get to meet Billy Wilder.
Right.
But that's what the right. terrifying part of the story was.
So we get to Mr. Wilder's office and knock on the door, and sure enough, there he is, you know, my idol, sitting behind a desk, and he kind of gets up and greets us, and the next thing you know, Taschen has left us, and Billy says, "Where did he go?" And I said, "I don't know. You know those Germans," which I don't know why I said that. You know, I don't know where it came from or even what it meant, but he seemed to think it was funny, mm-hmm. and he laughed, and we talked, and he said, "This is the best researched book I've ever seen," and I nearly burst into tears.
Yeah,
I was so thrilled to hear that from him, and then we went out to lunch, and we went to a restaurant called Mr. What is the name of the restaurant?
Mr. Chow's.
Mr. Chow's.
Is it Mr. Chow's?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Okay. Yeah, famous.
We went to a restaurant around the corner from his office called Mr. Chow's.
Yeah.
And the waiters didn't bring any menus because they knew exactly what he was going to order anyway, because mm-hmm. he was a regular. And suddenly plates of fiery hot Chinese food were coming, and Billy was 92 or something at the time. Mm-hmm. And he's wolfing it down like nobody's business, which I was just amazed by the whole thing. And it got a little awkward, though, because he was he would tell stories, of course, you know, which he was known for, but he would forget the ending. And I would supply it because I had just written his biography. And it got a little awkward, His wife then began,
Audrey
mm-hmm. The famous Audrey Wilder, began to take over and tell her greatest hits stories.
Mm-hmm. It's a great, great, amazing story.
So,
yeah,
when she entered the restaurant, she said, he said, "Audrey, my dear, this is the man who wrote the book." "What book?" "The big book. The big book." "Oh, that. Full of mistakes. Wrong, 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 wrong." And the next thing I know, she's waving her finger in my face and saying, you know, "No, no, 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 no. It's full of mistakes. And I knew where you got them and got those stories. And now they're replicating." And she makes the sign for infinity with her fingers twirling around, and I'm just dying because I think, oh my Lord, the whole thing is going down really bad.
Now, were you worried about just Billy losing faith in you or rescinding his endorsement? Is that what
no,
it was? 'Cause you already,
no, I just was worried that I had made gross mistakes.
Okay.
That would come back and haunt me. Mm-hmm. But she started telling, you know, it was clear after she told me what I got wrong that she had looked herself up in the index and read those portions and nothing else. So
I see.
which was fine with me, but she said, first of all, we didn't get married in Linden, Nevada. We got married in Minden, Nevada. And I said, well, I know exactly where I got that from. It was from Luella Parsons' column the day after you eloped. And she made the cuckoo sign around her temples and yeah. said, figures. And I thought, oh, my God, she's, you know,
yeah.
Here's Mrs. Billy Wilder making the cuckoo sign for about Luella Parsons. I'm just in hog heaven here.
well, for those who don't know, maybe Luella Parsons was a
gossip columnist along with
the 50s and
Hedda
60s.
Hopper. They were big rivals.
Right.
And they controlled the gossip industry in Hollywood.
They were very powerful.
Very powerful women. So she says that, and then she says, and Marlena never said that to me. And I'm kind of saying to myself, Marlena Dietrich.
Mm-hmm.
She's referring to Marlena Dietrich by her first name, to me,
mm-hmm.
little me.
yeah.
And I said, well... What are you referring to? And she said, our astrological signs are not, as you said, they were, you know, he's a Capricorn and I'm a Gemini or whatever.
Sure.
You know, I don't remember which what their astrological signs are.
Well, this is what got you in trouble, Ed, so you should remember this because
really,
you're now telling it again.
And I said to myself, well, mm-hmm. she can't sue over an astrological error.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that this can come back and haunt me financially. It's just a little embarrassing. So,
do you think that that Billy Wilder knew was putting this all in perspective? That he knew what his wife was kind of a little out there.
His wife was one of the most charming people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
She. At the end of the lunch, when we were getting ready, we were actually out the door, and he had been, Mr. Wilder, it was put in his car by his factotum
mm-hmm.
And driver. And Mrs. Wilder marched up to me and said, what I said back in there, stupid, 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 stupid. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, that stuff about the mistakes. That was just stupid of me. Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Mrs. Wilder, you are probably the most charming person I've ever met. You have nothing to be sorry for. And she shrugged and got in the car and left.
what was she thinking?
It was quite something.
People are complicated, you know. I can't even try to piece that together in any way that would make any difference.
It was kind of, the whole thing was surreal from my perspective. I mean,
yeah.
Here I was having lunch with this guy whose life I'd just written about,
mm-hmm.
And I knew all of his stories, and he was messing them up in the telling because he was an old man at that point.
Yeah, sure.
But and his wife Audrey was could sense that things were not going so well, and began doing, as I said, Audrey's greatest hits. Which included, you know, the time that she dyed Marilyn's hair for Some Like It Hot.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be Marilyn Monroe.
yeah, right.
You know, and I'm sitting there just in case.
Yeah,
you
right.
know.
You got her confused with Marilyn Edelman.
Yeah, exactly.
who has worked at the craft table.
Right.
Well, that's an incredible thing. You met your idol. You met the subject of the book. So the unauthorized was still endorsed.
Right.
He didn't know. It didn't necessarily not authorize it. He just didn't participate. Is that what you're saying?
It was not authorized. And as a matter of fact, Jack Lemmon refused to talk to me because it was unauthorized and he had a policy of not talking to anybody who didn't have the subject's permission.
I see.
To write the book. But
I guess that's something admirable,
told me that when he mentioned it to Billy Wilder, Mr. Wilder had said that the idea of sitting through an interview with me made him want to throw up. And I think he was referring not to me specifically, but I hope he wasn't referring to me specifically, but to a biography. Giving another biographical interview just was vomitous to him.
That's tricky, isn't it? It's like, I guess I can understand, like, 90, well, maybe 85 or something years old, how many interviews one is subjected to by that point.
Right. Many.
I have to sometimes keep that in mind myself when I try to approach certain subjects, you know, that if they never interviewed again, it would be too soon, you know, that
right.
kind of thing, because it's just so many people. But, you know.
Well, he was such a colorful storyteller and had such a way with words that he was a kind of go-to guy for anybody who wanted to write anything good about Hollywood for a while. They knew that if they went to Billy Wilder to get a quote, they would get a really good one.
Right.
He once said of Marilyn Monroe, for example, she has breasts like granite and a head like Swiss cheese.
So, yeah. I think that's the quote.
Yeah.
That was a compliment because it was after... Right, it was. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but after first of all being the only director to work with her twice, according to Ed Sykov, this is a fact.
I think so.
That no other director worked with Marilyn Monroe twice because she was difficult for one thing.
Very difficult.
Very difficult. Lateness, absence, maybe other issues, self-destructive or not, and so by the end of Something Like It Hot, things were a bit. Tetchy with him and her, mm-hmm. he and she, meaning Billy and Marilyn.
Yes.
And but as happens in Hollywood, friendships never die when the new project is coming about or whatever. I mean, it seems like very few real rifts or grudges really last. It's really an exception.
Right. He knew that she was great on the screen
right.
and was willing to put up with, you know, he'd had his first experience with her on The 7-Year Itch. Mm-hmm. And she was just constantly late to filming and he grew used to it. And he and the cinematographer or the set director or the art director, I can't remember, mm-hmm. used to go outside and play catch waiting for Marilyn to show up. What could you do?
Mm-hmm. Jack Lemmon said that, you know, during Something Like It Hot, he was there at 7 in the morning every morning ready to work, but it would have to sometimes wait like half the day till,
right.
you know, they could shoot a scene.
Asked what it was like to kiss the reigning sex goddess of the American screen, Tony Curtis said it was like kissing Hitler. She couldn't remember the line... Where is that bourbon? Oh, there it is. Mm-hmm. She just couldn't remember it. And they would start take 49, and she would just blow the line again. And finally, Billy began to get a little nervous and antsy and started to give her a direction. And she said, don't talk to me now. I'll forget how I'm going to play it.
Yeah, I mean, like so much focus was going on.
Yeah, a little too much focus, perhaps.
Yeah, right. And I think you wrote even in that moment, the scene is her back was to the camera, so I'm not sure why they couldn't fix that.
ADR. I think that's the way they fixed
it. ADR, but that's just sort of funny. But yeah, she does come off like brilliantly in that film. So it speaks to her. True talent, underlying talent, and his as a director, right? I mean, that she still comes off magnificently in that. And,
right.
You know,
right.
probably.
And she looks spectacular.
Yeah.
I mean, very few stars have that kind of just ethereal, yet extremely corporal appeal. Mm-hmm. And Wilder knew that she would come through in the end on the screen where it counted, so he was willing to put up with the
Michigas.
With the Michigas, yeah, exactly.
and then his other relationship, a female star during that period of time, who he also worked with on two films, couldn't have been further from the Marilyn Monroe type. It was Audrey Hepburn, right? Because he did. Sure. He worked with her on Sabrina and on Love in the Afternoon. Love in the Afternoon. And in both, she's just you know, breathtaking.
Absolutely. Absolutely breathtaking, breathtakingly gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And a totally different physical type, obviously. You know, she's so right. petite.
Yeah.
And delicate. Whereas Monroe comes off, well, let me put it this way. I taught the film to some students at Haverford College when I used to teach there. Mm-hmm. And they, to a person, rendered the judgment that she was just grotesquely fat. And I thought, wait a minute. That's not what people thought at the time.
That's
it's
yeah,
just,
bizarre.
It was really bizarre. And yeah. and it went to prove that today's notions of what constitutes female beauty are very different than they were when Monroe was a star.
Yeah, one could argue maybe her heaviest, maybe Elizabeth Taylor has struggled, but Marilyn Monroe may have been a little more voluptuous here and there, but in some films, but never remotely that.
Right. I mean,
besides, yeah, but you're absolutely right.
There's a somewhat off-color story that I'd like to tell.
Please, I look forward to that. I look forward to that.
Well, Ori Kelly was the costume designer for Something Like It Hot. And he said to Marilyn at one point, mm-hmm. referring to Tony Curtis, Tony's got a better ass than you do, and expecting that she'd be very upset. And she immediately pulled open her blouse and said, but he doesn't have tits like these.
Oh, my goodness, I'm turning red here. You know, but you bring up a point. Billy Wilder was a pretty raunchy guy,
yeah,
wasn't he? And
very.
The sets could get a little raunchy, and he was always having a... he was always really pushing hard against the code folks, right? The Hollywood code.
Yeah, the production code.
Production code folks.
The Hayes office. And
yeah.
Yeah.
He was really responsible, almost single-handedly, for bringing us to where we are today.
Yeah, but you he know, did it with such class that... Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing left out of most of the equation.
In the equation, yeah. It sort of became completely devoid of class. But he... you know, you can't help but notice that the first film that he directed, The Major and the Minor, is basically... flirting with the idea of pedophilia.
Yep.
Ginger Rogers is forced to play a 12-year-old girl.
Just to get a free ticket on
girl.
The train.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or reduced price, whatever.
Yeah. She's trying to leave New York and she can't afford a full price ticket. So she gets to buy a child's ticket, which means that she has to become a child. And Ray Milland falls for her as a child.
It's handled well, though.
It's handled very
subtly.
Because
he doesn't realize he's got these urges, and he's not really... He's struggling with his... with his feeling of that he's struggling with these feelings. And
right.
But he doesn't act on them.
No, he doesn't act on
them. As long
as
he feels like she... Or does he at the end?
Well, they get together at the end, but by that point, she's not a girl anymore, a little girl.
Okay, I couldn't remember if he accidentally... made a pass at her, and then it comes out.
No, he gets some particularly funny looks in his eyes.
Yeah.
But that's as far as it goes.
Okay.
But still, it's there, and you can't help but notice that in his first film in Hollywood as a director, he Wilder, chooses to do this very, very iffy project.
Yeah. And gets away with it.
And gets away with it, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a comedy of errors. It's a little... I mean, it's not like Shakespeare didn't do these things a few centuries before, but Hollywood is a lot more puritanical than Stratton-on-Avon.
Right.
Whatever.
Right.
Know.
When I was researching the book, I grew to understand that the screenwriters, like, Billy Wilder and his partner Charles Brackett would deliberately throw things into the script, into the first draft of the script that they knew would be cut out because they just were expecting.
You're playing a game.
It was a game, yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Exactly.
Makes complete sense.
So they would give the censors something to do, and they would do it, and then they would write something much more subtle for what they actually planned to film.
Yeah. They had all sorts of ways of navigating that.
Sure.
Right? I mean, any director or screenwriter, in this case worth his salt, would be able to figure out how to work the system, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right? Right? Because if you look through a lot of these films, there's always something suggestive going on, at the very least.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's there. It's great through many films. I'm trying to think if I left any out that during those early years. But do you have a personal favorite yourself? Or they're all your children, even though they're Billy Wilder's children. But do you have like a favorite?
I have a couple of favorites.
Mm-hmm.
In no particular order, Sunset Boulevard.
Mm.
Well, Double Indemnity is one of them.
Well, it's a great example.
It's a terrific
risque scene.
Yeah.
Barbara Stanwyck comes out in a towel. It's a great example of another early film where they have a risque scene. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
And
Sunset Boulevard and
Some
Like It Hot. And also a film called Ace in the Hole, which he made in 1951, right after Sunset Boulevard. And it is a truly nasty movie. It's the nastiest movie of his career, and it was a big bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shocked at the audience response. People just didn't go to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd never really experienced that before. And so he never quite went that far again because it was a disaster.
Yeah. And you say after Ace in the Hole, which he wrote, that it took like another 8 films before he would write another original screenplay that he would direct, right?
Yeah, he did adaptations. Adaptations, yeah, of plays. And in one case, an autobiography, Spirit of St. Louis, which is a very bizarre film for him to direct.
Right.
It was the Lindbergh story. And
again,
what he thought he was going to do with it is remains obscure to me.
And it's another example of where he seems to not have a big problem with. He has a Nazi problem on his hands, at least Nazi sympathizer problem,
right?
And yet, manages to make a movie about a Nazi sympathizer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And who did help with publicity? I think right after the film came out.
Sure.
Right? Charles Lindbergh was a big bomb as well, a flop.
Mm-hmm.
The movie was a flop as well, and it miscast Jimmy Stewart.
And it had cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
It was a very expensive film to make, and it just bombed.
Yeah. But fortunately, he would rebound with like 3 or 4 huge successes every time he
absolutely,
made it.
Absolutely, yeah.
In the couple of cases where he made bombs or flops. But, did he ever... I mean, as we said, there was a... Ace in the Hole was a big flop. I mean, financially, I think it remains his top favorite film, or if not, one of his top favorite films, right?
Yeah, he loved it. He achieved exactly what he set out to achieve, which is to make a movie that depicts American culture as just, to use a word that's been used by our president lately, a shithole.
Mm-hmm.
Billy saw America at its worst and portrayed it as such in that film.
It's satire, is it not? Or do you think it's too close to?
I think it's. I wouldn't call it satire exactly, but it's. Well, the story of the film is that a guy gets trapped in a cave because he's stealing Indian artifacts, and Kirk Douglas plays a reporter who milks the story for all it's worth, and essentially keeps the guy trapped for the sake of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And people come from all over the place to be spectators to this disaster, this human horror story, and
just hope to see the guy, you know, not survive, right?
Right.
In a way,
right. And or they're kind of looking for a fake happy ending where the guy's going to be rescued at the last minute and he'll go on and live. But a carnival,
right,
shows up at the site of the trapped man in the mountain, and on the side of the trucks bringing the carnival in is written the S&M carnival company or something. It's the S&M whatever, but it's quite funny.
It is funny, but the carnival, of course, was already there in a sense, right?
Right.
But maybe that was the point. Yeah, and then now, I mean, finally, at least film lovers have caught up with Billy Wilder in the sense that Ace in the Hole has now been given a second life, right? It's now considered a gem.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And the same holds true, I think, with a film that he made in Berlin at the very time that the wall went up, which is 1-2-3. The movie was not a success at the time. Mm-hmm. The Germans in particular hated it, but now I'm told that it's quite popular in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That they finally see the humor in the bifurcated Berlin.
Mm-hmm. He managed to work with like every big star. Did he ever work with Cary Grant? I mean, so because you mentioned Kirk Douglas and Ace in the Hole, and just mentioned right now, 1-2-3 was Jimmy Cagney in one of his latter day roles.
Yeah, and of course, as a matter of fact, he hated working for Wilder so much that he decided to quit filmmaking.
Oh, he retired
And didn't make another film until Ragtime.
Ragtime, but that makes good copy.
Yeah.
But I guess he did stop working though. But he worked with Edward G. Robinson on Double Indemnity, right? And Fred McMurray, of course. He worked with, Bogart in Sabrina.
Mm-hmm.
Who also had a kind of a difficult relationship with Wilder, right?
Yes.
Everybody wanted to be coddled, and everybody felt like they were being ignored. I mean, this keeps coming
right
up because
it happened with Peter Sellers in
being there.
Kiss Me Stupid.
There. Where did that come up? Kiss Me Stupid, of course.
Yeah. He was originally going to be starring in the film, and he hated Wilder's working methods. Mm-hmm. He liked a closed set, and Wilder's sets were anything but. Friends would show up, friends of his wife would show up just to watch him work. And he loved it. He thought it was great fun, and Sellers just was miserable, and got so miserable, in fact, that he had a heart attack and had to drop out of the production. But to which Mr. Wilder said, "Heart attack? You have to have a heart before you can have an attack."
Great writer. That's what you're. Yep. That's what you get.
He was replaced by Ray Walston.
Oh, he had the Ray Walston part. Okay.
Yeah,
he I'm had not the remembering Ray all my act. I apologize. So Dean Martin was always cast. He was always supposed to play himself.
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
He plays Dino,
yeah.
Who is obviously Dean Martin, but.
Well, Dean Martin, he went by Dino, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
But it wasn't his kid that went by Dino. No, it was him.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. So he took his nickname and made it the name of the character, who's a variation of himself. So.
Right.
Yeah. It was very, I thought it was very unusual, one of his very unusual films, especially at that point.
Yeah, the Legion of Decency rated it C for Condemned.
maybe it's based on quality. It wasn't necessarily one of his best.
I happen to have a particular fondness for it, but
it's an
maybe it's an acquired
film.
Taste.
Maybe, but no, I'm just thinking, you know, compared to some of his other, it seemed like almost a bit of a toss-off. It wasn't necessarily, but it's inspired. It's a lot of fun, and it has a certain amount of energy to it that you can't argue with, you know, right? And it's a number of great character actors in it.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And of course, Dino Martin. Yeah, I would have to say Some Like It Hot, though, was a big thing in my growing up in my house, because that was like one of my parents' favorite comedies. So
sure, it was one of the films that was a big hit at the time. It didn't require aging like a fine wine before it got good. It was the second or third biggest box office blockbuster in that year that it came out, 1959. Mm-hmm. I think the only film that did better was Pillow Talk.
Really?
I think so.
Wow. That's amazing, right?
Yeah.
That shows you where most
and, of... And seeing the film with an audience, it still works today. The jokes still have a zip to them that
sure.
that many old comedies just don't. Mm-hmm. In fact, it kind of pains me to think of it as an old comedy.
Yeah. So Someone That Loved It has a great place in my heart, as do a number of the earlier films we were talking about. But I have to say, for my personal favorite Billy Wilder movie has always been The Apartment. For me, it's like it hits all the points, the drama, the comedy, you know, the screwball comedy. It's all there in one movie, you know, and heartbreak. I love that.
It's everything.
Yeah. I mean, Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon have wonderful chemistry. Such great chemistry.
Terrific.
You know, I mean, you just...
Terrific. There's a moment in the film which I particularly like, where she looks at she takes out her compact mirror and to show it to Jack Lemmon, who's wearing a ridiculous hat, and he wants to look at himself wearing the hat and appreciate his great-looking hat. Mm-hmm. But the compact mirror is broken, which he, of course, notices, and he says to her, "It's broken," and she says, it makes me look the way I feel." And it's such a simple line, but it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. And she attempts suicide. And
yeah, it's a comedy
that.
About suicide.
Yeah. But he does that in his movies.
Right.
It's not the opening sequence. It's early, though. In Some Like a Hot, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It's a pretty violent scene.
It's pretty grim.
It's very grim, right? And then the rest is kind of like this screwball, madcap type farce that we see, right?
Yeah, he appreciated blending genres.
He did it exceptionally well.
Right.
And most people doubted that he could pull it off, and he kept doing it.
Right.
Maybe speaks more to his genius than almost anything else. Huh? So for those interested, pretty much everything's available. I mean, he's one of these directors whose entire oeuvre is pretty much findable. I think I had to order a copy, and it has not arrived yet. So it's one of the few things, but it's not his greatest work, which is the Bing Crosby film. Emperor Waltz, which is not one of his best known films.
It's a Technicolor musical, which appears on the surface to be the exact opposite kind of movie that he would want to make.
Right.
But his wife...
at the time. Was he already married to Audrey?
He was married to Audrey, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Someone I know asked her, a guy named Michael Thomas, asked her, why did he want to make The Emperor Waltz? It seems so un-Billy Wilder.
Right.
And she said, Billy loved that Viennese shit.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Right.
Maybe there's still, at that period, he was sort of working out some of his memories and his feelings to his Vienna and to his childhood. And makes sense. And then, but almost anything else. I mean, you can just find it all. It's very easy.
There was some problem with Ace in the Hole for a while.
Now it's still on Criterion.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I mean, you might have to sort of do a, if you don't want to subscribe to Filmstruck, you might have to do the 2-week trial or whatever they offer to make Ace in the Hole a top choice, because I believe it's there, unless I'm mistaken, which means that you can get it also on the Criterion Collection.
Yeah.
Like if you want to buy a copy.
Right.
You know, or something. I'm pretty sure everything else is out there in one form or another, whether, you know, on one service or another, or on DVD anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So it's very, so you can find any of these, or just keep, you know, TCM on rotate on all times, because
all the time, yeah.
Yeah, because it's there's
sooner or later they'll show
like
up.
You know, because if they ever do like a Barbara Stanwyck, I mean, when they do, I shouldn't say when, if they ever, because they always do the Barbara Stanwyck day, and then they do the Humphrey Bogart day, and then mm-hmm. they do the Fred McMurray day, and then they do the, you know, Ray Milland day. Maybe not a Ray Milland day, though he's a very good actor. But there's so many, he's worked with so many great actors that invariably all these movies get a regular play on TCM.
Right, so. Right. They're pretty universally universally loved.
Right. It's a startlingly great career, and same for you. Your books are great. I can't wait to read the Peter Sellers. I might.
Oh,
and then
you.
There was one. What was that one called?
Mr. Strangelove.
Mr. Strangelove. That's a good title. Very good title. Probably my favorite comedy of all time. Even above The Apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
It's not so shocking, right? It's a
no,
more,
no.
One of America's favorites, right?
Right. Who cannot love a film about a nuclear holocaust?
Exactly. Which the title dares you to do. And then you said also you have a book on Betty Davis, right?
Dark Victory, yeah.
Dark Victory. Do you know the podcast? There's a podcast. Do you listen to any? There's
no.
This one I want to turn you on to, about old Hollywood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, great, great storyteller who does a great amount of work and background. And just, she's amazing, and she does a series. I think you'd really like it.
Who is it?
Well, her name is Karina Longworth.
Hmm.
But I'll get that for you. Anyhow, I think, did we forget anything? So, again, the name of the book is called On Sunset Boulevard, The Life and Times of Billy Wilder. The author's Ed Sykov. It's published by, make sure I get the right name of the publisher here. You can interrupt if you want to. But.
It's published by the University Press of Mississippi, of all places.
Oh, very good.
Uh-huh. It was originally published by Hyperion, which was Disney's publishing company.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, anyway, so it's coming up to its 20th anniversary this year, though, your book.
Wow. Makes me feel old.
Sorry, Ed. You said you published in 1998.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's amazing that it's 20 years old already.
I know, right? It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, people should pick up a copy, do themselves a favor. And it's a great way, do it like I did, which is read the book, but while you're reading it, go back and watch all the films, because it's a great way to experience
it's meant to be seen, to be read with the films. It spends a lot of time on the films and their meanings and their productions, and I think the book benefits from simultaneous viewing of his films.
Absolutely true. Yeah, as I said, you know, being the age I am, I've seen a lot of them, you know, in the past, but to rewatch them within, you know, and knowing. Reading about the book, the stories of the making of the films is really, it's a nice companion. It's a nice companion to it.
Good.
So I'm really been enjoying the last couple of months doing that. Mm. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great meeting you. Music on this episode is by the musical artist The Kills. Check out their website for more details about this exceptional artist. So often I invite somebody on the show to talk about, like for 5-10 minutes at the very top, I try to occasionally bring them on to maybe talk about a Kickstarter campaign or, you know, a crowdfunded campaign or maybe something that's coming up. But this is the case here with this young guy, Joseph Lingad, who I really invited to maybe just quickly plug his Kickstarter because I really felt it was a worthwhile project. And it ended up, we were talking for 45 minutes. It's a, such a great project. First of all, you go to Kickstarter and see what I mean and search Don't Look Away or Joseph Lingad, you could, or Lingad. You could look up however you want to look up. It's L-I-N-G-A-D. He's about two-thirds of the way to his goal. He's about two-thirds of the way to the goal date. So he's getting there, but he could use the help. And it's the documentary follows the daily lives and experiences of several different adults with facial differences, you know, often referred to as deformities or disfigurements. But in this case, we're just talking about people that look different. And so the idea is to destigmatize that. And that's what the documentary is trying to do. And it's what Joseph is trying to do. But what, when Joseph started talking about the film, he also opened up about his own experiences. And he was so transparent and honest. I really was moved. And that's why this just developed into a full segment, and I'm happy for it. So here it is right now. This is Joseph Lingad regarding his new project called Don't Look Away, a film about adults with facial differences, right here on Film Wax Radio.
One, two, three, four.
Joseph Lingad, do you remember when we met? I don't know.
We met
probably through Ted, probably through George, maybe.
Yeah, at one of the screenings in Dumbo. He was showing his short film. Red Right Return? No, that's his feature length.
Yeah, Red Right Return.
He did a short film with Chris Lankow.
Oh, Lincolnow.
Lincolnow, yeah.
Christopher Lincolnow.
Yes.
Yeah, the actor.
So he did a short film with him. And
oh, right. Yeah, is it, that's right. I forgot. In fact, where he works in a hotel or something?
Yeah, he works.
Which was real. Like, I think Chris did work in a hotel.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I forgot about that. Yeah, we did that.
And then his friend is the DP that he usually works with, Chris Mawson, right?
I don't know.
Okay. He's the one who shot his films.
Okay. Okay.
he was there. He works in the industry, I mean, obviously.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's where we met.
Okay. And did you work with George on any of that stuff? Or?
Did I work with George with... Actually, no. I read his scripts, and he actually borrowed my 7D camera, I think.
Oh, well, that helps. That's a nice thing. To lend somebody the equipment.
Yeah. I told him he still has that offer. I'm like, you, if it's for personal stuff, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you could borrow it for free.
Yeah,
but when you're doing corporate gigs, throw me like a beer or something.
Yeah, no, beer equals like, you know, $300 or something.
Yeah.
a unit of beer equals $300.
Right.
It's funny because owner,
he lent
me a Zoom like when I started doing this, and he just said keep it after all. I'm like, no, I'm gonna, you know, well, I still have it.
Right.
I've since upgraded, but
right.
I've done hundreds of podcast conversations with his Zoom,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
And I guess my way is to help continue to promote everything he's done over the years.
He's doing well, really well.
Yeah, you know, owners, God bless him. He's a complex guy.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know about
like his films. His films are complex.
They are. You're right. It's true. It's very true.
The first one I saw was the marriage one.
Which one?
The one, God, it was 3 or 4 years ago about some marriage happening in Central Park.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Richard's Wedding.
Richard's Wedding. Yes, right. Yes.
That was his first film here.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that, oh, was that, it?
Yeah.
Okay.
In Brooklyn, yeah. That's the one I'm in.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I was in that movie,
right.
Richard's Wedding. And then he hasn't. And then I was in I did a few things with him, but I was in another thing he did. And then I'm in a party scene in the Catfight film.
The what?
Catfight.
Catfight. I haven't seen
it. Oh, you haven't
that.
Seen that one?
No.
Well, that's his last, second to last movie, the Misogynists. That's the most recent.
Okay.
A very funny movie, but it's really it's over the top.
Okay, over the top, like
the lessons. Just the performances and the storyline. I mean, okay. Everything about it, the performances especially. So you're directing a project. Is it a short or a feature?
It's a feature length. I'm trying to do a feature length documentary.
Oh, documentary. Okay. Yeah. And so now you've started Kickstarter? And as of today, which is the 20th, is today the 23rd or 24th?
Today is the 24th. My phone.
February the 24th. 24th. Yeah, of February. So, you are about a week in. And, yeah.
10 days.
Okay, 10 days.
Yeah.
And you've got now 100
backers, and backers. We're a third way into reaching our goal.
Okay. And what is that?
It's I think almost 12,000.
You're trying to raise 12,000,
or you've raised reached almost 12,000.
Oh, very good.
I'm trying to reach 35,000.
Okay, very good. So it's around the amount I raised.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, okay. I did a Kickstarter recently.
Mm-hmm. Okay, recently for what?
For the podcast primarily, okay. To raise money for all new equipment, to raise money for all sorts of, to build a permanent space. Okay. Eventually, that's, you know, hopefully this year.
Okay.
And also for a bunch of other ancillary things. Yeah.
So that I feel like a jerk for not there, that, knowing.
Well, it's never too late.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. True. But I may do what I'm going to do is like a Patreon thing. Now, Kickstarter has their own version. It's called Drip.
Mm-hmm.
So you should look into that too.
I'm new to Kickstarter.
Me too. I was new too. But the thing is, they've started a thing, but it's good for a serial type of project, let's say like episodic.
Okay,
right. Or a web series or
a
podcast. Because Patreon is like almost subscribing. It's like you're asking for, you're building a subscribership as opposed to Kickstarter, which is all one goal.
Right.
And you meet it or you don't.
Ah, okay.
In our two cases, we will or will we already have met the goals.
Okay.
Yeah. Being optimistic. So the Patreon is like a lot of podcasters have Patreon. So you can go to the website and you can sign on to their Patreon account.
Okay.
And you can get like $5 an episode.
Mm-hmm.
So it automatically deducts that from your whatever card you put up there. Or it could be $25, whatever you want to do. But it's every time. So once you sign on, it's, unless you cancel it, it's going to be an ongoing thing. So you try to get people to, let's say, even if it's $1 an episode, if you get hundreds of people to do it, it builds up to like, you know, a way of monetizing your thing.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
It makes more sense for something that's ongoing.
Right. I mean, I'll buy this episode.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's an investment in yourself, I guess. So tell me about the documentary and what you're trying to raise money. Again, the Kickstarter will be ending March 15th, you said?
March 15th.
So.
And so the film is called Don't Look Away, a film about adults with facial differences. Facial differences. And so the question is, what is a facial difference? And the facial difference is usually referred to as a person who has a facial disfigurement. I'm replacing disfigurement or what's another word? Deformity with the word facial difference.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Because, like, you know, I was born with a cleft lip and have scars to show forth.
Uh-huh.
And so you don't, for example, don't have scars. And so it's not necessarily a deformity. You know, there's a negative connotation to
that. I have
a
scar.
Oh, you do?
I resent it. I just cover it with a beard.
Oh, I try to cover it with my horrible mustache.
Yeah, but you know, you look good. You're a good looking guy.
So I'm just trying to say
that was
it's just a difference.
Is that a little patronizing when I said that?
What?
But you're, which is in a way to make myself comfortable when you're talking about deformity. I totally see,
I see what you
replacing
mean.
The word deformity. I think that's a really great idea.
Right.
Oh, interesting.
It's more empowering for people who do have a facial difference.
Sure.
And words do matter, you know.
Sure do. Yeah. Absolutely.
So actually, I belong to this organization called About Face.
Uh-huh.
It's a nonprofit organization based in Canada. They provide multiple services like kids and adults. And so I'm part of this group that's actually trying to define what a facial difference is.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, it's usually people. I could give examples of a facial difference, like cleft lips, Bell's palsy, microtia.
What's that?
Microtia is, I believe, you have undeveloped ears or small ears.
And Bell's palsy is
a paralyzation of half your face.
Which is either temporary or permanent, depending on your case.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then hemifacial, craniofacial, uh-huh. which is what... Have you seen the teaser?
No.
Oh.
I should have.
it's basically underdeveloped facial structure.
Uh-huh.
Or in some cases, you don't have bone cheeks.
Cheekbones, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So having a definition of what a facial difference is will eventually help people understand the word. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or
right. Well, but are the people, the subjects of the film, or what you're exploring, is the word congenital? What's the word? It's not congenital.
It's either when you're born acquired or congenital.
It doesn't matter. You could be in some sort of accident, or exactly. It could just come later in life.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily. When did they correct, and I'm putting invisible hash marks around the word
right,
correct,
right.
your cleft? Was it called a cleft lip?
Right. It's a cleft lip and a
cleft palate. Is a different thing.
It goes up to your palate.
Oh, I see.
And so, like, I think, wow. I think I don't want to like... Some actors I don't want to name.
I had one recently on the phone. My podcast.
I saw that. I wanted.
And you could hear it.
Listen, I mean, watch it or listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
George sent me that. George actually sent me. Link to listen to.
Yeah. It didn't come up because, I mean, it just.
Really.
It didn't come up in conversation.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Ever since I've known him, it was corrected. So, I knew him when he was a kid.
Oh, really?
This particular actor. Yeah.
Okay.
We had a personal relationship, personal friendship.
I believe he has just a cleft lip.
Okay. I don't know.
So if you've seen pictures, like a cleft palate, cleft lip is your lip that's mm-hmm, connected mm-hmm. to your nose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe like a cleft palate also goes up to your nose.
Yeah.
And they have to like repair that. And it's more severe.
I guess so.
I've had like about 16 surgeries.
You have had 16?
Yeah.
Really?
15 or 16, I lost
count.
Can
you tell me the time frame for that?
From ever since I was born. And
right.
Then,
so why, before you went home?
What do you mean?
Before you went home. In other words, you were a mother, gave birth to you in the hospital.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So before you even went home with her? Did you already have surgery then? Or was
No. I had my first surgery after a few months okay. I was born.
Well, that would make more sense that yeah. you have a little strength and size and weight.
Right, yeah.
But where was this?
I was actually born in the Philippines.
Right, okay.
And then I came to the States when I was four.
Okay.
And then I got my surgeries at Children's Hospital in LA. It was a famous plastic surgeon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
wow.
By the
he
name of Dr. Reinisch, John Reinisch.
Okay. Is he still around?
He's still around. I sent him an email.
Should be in your film.
Thanking him.
What better way to end it? You could include him in your film, of course.
Right, possibly.
Or yeah. even as a thank you at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I know, yeah, so.
So you had all those surgeries.
Yeah.
Like a little kid, you poor
my last surgery when I was 20 years old.
Okay.
The biggest one was a jaw surgery. They basically wire your jaw for a month. And it's basically a good way to lose weight. It's all you could eat is
right.
liquid.
Oh my gosh. Can I ask you, I'm sorry, we kind of got off on this tangent.
Oh yeah, sorry.
But I am curious to know your experiences since it's germane to your documentary.
Yeah.
And I think people will feel more, that are listening would feel more bonded with you hearing your experiences. But just to have those experiences as a kid, That had to be really difficult because, you know, I mean, just being a kid is hard enough.
Right,
and then
right.
to go through all that. Your family, were they pretty great around that?
I had a different childhood.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say this, but not to, like, garner pity. I'm not trying to, like, ask people to pity me or anything. But after 10 years old, my mom died when I was 2 months old.
All right, a little pity. So
yeah, yeah.
We're gonna have to have a little pity for that.
Yeah,
that's pretty. You were too.
Well, nice. I'm explaining. I'm gonna explain all these.
Sure.
Because it kind of shaped who I am.
Yeah. Please.
And also, mm-hmm. I also want to contrast like my experience of in terms of like not having a great foundation, like a parental foundation, and then you compare it with Jane, who was a young woman in the teaser, and she her parents, whom I met, were amazing, and like they really gave her support and gave her a strong foundation. So when she went to the real world, or when she went out in the real world, and people stared at her or teased her, she knew how to deal with it a lot better than I did, because I didn't have that foundation. My mom died when I was 2, and then my dad left us when I was 10. And so basically my older sister, who took care of me. My siblings took care of me, 2 sisters and my brother.
Okay. You're the youngest of 4?
I'm the youngest of 4, okay. Yeah. Hmm. And so that kind of
shapes you, yeah.
Shaped me. And then so I didn't actually, we never really talked about my cleft lip, cleft palate, and the scar, except for my brother, when some of the kids in the neighborhood I was living in would sometimes tease me. Mm-hmm. And so my brother, he's 9.5 years old, older than me, would come out and
defend you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So you grew up, where'd you grow up? What town? After you were 4 and you moved here, I mean.
Yeah, mainly in San Gabriel, which is near Pasadena.
Okay, so you grew up in Southern California.
Yeah, Southern California, and Orange County as well.
Okay, so all these surgeries, were most of them before you were 10?
I had about, before I was 10, I probably had 5 or 6
okay.
surgeries.
And because, so did you... Was there just insurance? Of course, may have been a little easier to come by then.
Insurance, sure. Yeah.
How it was well covered, or
I was under Medicaid.
Oh, very good.
For a short amount of time.
Yeah,
or I would say several years, and then once my sister took custody of me, became my legal guardian. I got under her insurance.
Sure, that makes sense.
And I had to switch hospitals.
I see.
From Children's Hospital, which is top notch, to
best, right?
Kaiser, which is good.
Right.
But
all of a sudden you were used to a certain level of service and treatment. So
right,
it had to be a shift there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm grateful that my surgeon at Kaiser Permanente, they were great. They treated me well. Mm-hmm. It was just a different, little different experience.
Right.
I just also want to say, just in case they're listening, because I created a bond with my surgeon, Dr. Reinisch. I had surgeries with him from 5 to I would say almost 12. And so I created this bond with him. And then they told me I'm having a different surgeon. And so I have to create this new trust.
Right.
With a different surgeon. So that was the most difficult part.
Right. Yeah. It took a long time to form a trust, that bond, and
right.
create that. And then there is an emotional component to that.
Right. I never confronted my facial difference. What I mean by confronted, meaning kind of tried to come to terms with my facial difference.
Yeah.
Until I was 30, young 30. I'm 36. Uh-huh. But at one point, I was I kind of need help on how to express my frustration and my angst. Mm-hmm. And so I looked online and I found About Face. And then they have this retreat every year, this adult retreat. Mm-hmm. And it's comprised with adults with various facial conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we talked about before.
Yeah, that's where I kind of so when I went there the first year, it was a eye-opening in the sense that here I am filled with adults who know my experiences.
Right.
Actually, one of them shared the same surgeon, Dr. Reinisch. Out of all, she now lives in Washington. She came from Washington State. Mm-hmm. And here we are in Toronto area.
Mm.
We, after several conversations in, we realized we shared the same surgeon.
And you already had relocated to...
New York, yeah. So this was 3 years ago.
Okay.
So, mm-hmm. So and then the idea came finally. I was you know what? Why not do a documentary?
Out of that retreat?
That kind of sparked it.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you which came first. Okay.
Yeah, that kind of sparked it. I'm you know what? Why not make a documentary on adults with facial differences?
I can see the process. Here you go from feeling going from a very, from this sort of isolation, mm-hmm. and then through the group, through About Face and through that community mm-hmm. of people, you ventured in, you know, you were allowed yourself to become more, I don't want to say public, but you were emerging from isolation mm-hmm. of that of experience being very isolating.
Right.
And now the next logical step is, as a filmmaker, would be to want to do something like that and to do a documentary and to put it out there, even to people who you're not meeting. You know, of course, once it's out there, you'll meet a lot of new people.
Can I expose myself?
Right. To put it out there in the universe. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still getting used to that.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I'm still a little uneasy about it.
Well, it sounds, though, your body language and the way you talk about it almost sounds like somebody's come out of the closet who's hidden
right.
Very essential aspects of their identity and their personality and right. who don't want to do that anymore, and it's scary as hell.
Right.
Know, right.
I find this part of this process is kind of therapeutic. Mm-hmm. I'm actually finding, you know, expression, finding myself in these people's stories, in these people's unique stories. I see a lot of myself in their stories, and it's been very helpful for my sense of, like, again, coming to terms with my facial difference, meaning just like self acceptance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as somebody who's met you long after you sort of have, you know, had the surgeries, et cetera, and you know, it wasn't something I even see.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Interesting. But
that's like a different topic too.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Then you have all of a sudden, where am I now? Who am I now?
Right.
Right. I'm sure after you've, again, quote unquote, corrected your right. situation, now it's like, well, who is this Joseph Lingad, and where does he fit in my whole life that I've had, you know? And, you know, and, you know, especially people who are meeting you now as opposed to before, you know,
right.
who maybe knew you over the course of those, of that transformation of, you know, and all that means.
Mm-hmm.
The money you're raising for the Kickstarter for your documentary, which again is called
Don't Look Away.
Don't Look
Away. A film about adults with facial differences.
Got it. That's the subtitle. What are you raising the money for?
I'm trying to raise $35,000 to have a small crew mm-hmm. of, like, a sound person.
So to hire people.
To hire sound person and assistant.
Okay.
Just three of us. And
so somebody who's
going to. And I'm not even being paid for it.
So you're going to hold the crew? I mean, you're going to hold the camera?
Yes. Luckily, I have a background of camera stuff. My full-time job is a videographer, actually.
Okay. And then you got somebody who can check the lavs and maybe hold a boom.
Whatever
it makes. Okay.
Yeah, and then an assistant.
And then somebody who can just do the, but it's all the rest of the stuff right. while
and like,
you're shooting.
So a lot of, so I plan to have about 5 to 6 people in this doc. To tell their stories. But they all live in various parts of United States and Canada.
Right, so you have to travel.
So the travel expenses, as you know, adds up.
Sure, they do. Are we going to go on a retreat with you?
Well,
are we going on a retreat? In other words, us, the viewers of your film, will we have the go on? Are you going to go to the retreat that you'd mentioned in Toronto or outside Toronto?
Oh, you mean like film that?
Be part of that? Yeah. It's a personal thing.
I thought about it last year. So last year was my second time going to the retreat.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about, you know, possibly shooting it as a B-roll. And I said, you know what? I don't want that. I think that's as a personal space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people go there from various countries. They
right.
spend money, and they want to, like,
I gotcha.
You know, kind of like get out of the spotlight, so to speak.
Did you find any of your subjects?
Oh, yeah, the characters in mm-hmm. the film. Yes,
yeah.
I did. So one of them actually lives in Staten Island. Her name is Adele. She grew up in Brooklyn, and another one, Jane, who has a twin sister who wasn't born with a facial difference, she lives in Rochester.
Oh, very close.
So
that's good.
So I found, so yeah.
Half
so,
your group is here, is nearby.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And then, so there's, and then there's one in Washington State, and then there's two or three possibly in Toronto area.
Well, that's pretty close.
Yeah, so yeah, but it adds up.
Sure.
Like, for example, the teaser. I actually shot that as a one-man band. except for one day, I hired an assistant. Mm-hmm. It's the male character in the teaser. He lives in the Toronto area. So I contrasted that experience with 2 weeks ago. I shot Jane's birthday. I hired a sound person, an assistant, mm-hmm. and the two experiences were so different. I was able to focus on the storytelling aspect when I had a sound person mm-hmm. and an assistant, as opposed to being a one man band. I feel like I'm compromising everything when I have to do it on my own. Mm-hmm. So going back to the question of like, why do I need help, and what's this money going towards to?
Well, that wasn't my question.
Oh, what was your question? like?
No, I mean, I wasn't saying why, but what for?
What for?
Because people understand if they're going to kick in what they're kicking in for, you know?
It's basically for the crew, travel expenses.
Yeah, production costs.
Production rentals. Costs.
Right.
Camera rentals, sure. Lighting rentals.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. And again, it's don't turn away.
Don't look away.
Don't look away. The name of the film is going to be Don't Look Away.
Don't Look Away.
And then
a film about adults with facial differences.
Not children. That makes sense. I like that it's the adults because also they have a frame of reference. They have a life to look back on, you know, and many of these people, have they had surgeries like yourself?
Yeah.
To correct the...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Like this guy, Matt, mm-hmm. he's had about 30 surgeries.
Oh, Jesus. Wow. Yeah. Huge. That's like, I can understand how this can define your life. Because not only do you have this thing that separates you or differentiates you, but your life surrounds surgeries. I mean, you know, you're either you've just had a surgery or you're going to have a surgery.
Right.
It's remarkable.
And he's about 30 years old.
Yeah.
And so,
wow.
Yeah. And so there's another person I'm having a conversation with. He lives somewhere upstate New York, and he's about 28, 29, and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. he's going to have a surgery again. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I just can't imagine mm-hmm. having surgeries.
Yeah.
Up until like, I don't know, 30s.
Yeah. Because it's like you're getting towards, well, you're still about a third of your life.
Yeah.
You know, I think you can still, I mean, there's so much ahead to,
right.
you know, and without surgery. So,
yeah.
You know, but I'd love people just to go and check out your Kickstarter. Go to Kickstarter, search under Don't Look Away.
It's actually a Kickstarter away,
for
staff pickup. Or staff, or what do they label it as?
Staff
Projects We Love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So, you know, that's great. And then don't look away. Search that or Lingad, LINGAD. You can search either way. And
it also has a Facebook page.
Okay.
So it's called Don't Look Away.
Join the community around this great project. I think it's a great project.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm going up to Toronto in April for hot dogs.
For what?
It's a good place to go. Hot dogs.
Hot dogs. You're going there for hot dogs.
Hot dogs, yeah. So you might be there next April.
Are you going to Toronto? I'm sorry, just for hot dogs? I mean, what do you mean? An event for hot dogs or for Toronto?
No. Hot dogs.
Oh, hot dogs!
It's a big festival.
I think you said hot dogs. I'm like,
no, the hot dogs are good too. No, I have also have very good friends up there.
Oh, I see.
But
I love Toronto.
Yeah, it's a great town, and but it would be great if you can get maybe you can have a screening there in 2019.
In April?
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, you'll have a festival, you'll have a number, you'll have to decide where you want to premiere your documentary, and then they have to agree to it, I suppose. Whether you're going to choose what festival, you know, for when it all comes together. But thank you for stopping by, and thank you for sharing that very intimate story about your own experiences.
Yeah.
You know, and this was supposed to be 5 minutes.
Oh, was it?
Damn
Sorry.
You. It's a half hour.
Oh, can I say one last thing?
Yeah, sure, of course.
I just want another reason why I wanted to create this film, or several reasons.
Yeah,
real fast. One of them is to create some type of platform to have these characters tell their stories.
Right.
And another reason is just to create awareness and tolerance towards people with facial differences. I think it's a subject that's really kind of like taboo, or people don't really want to talk about or kind of ignore.
Right.
You know? So, yeah.
This is an instance of something that doesn't discriminate, against anyone. Regardless of their religion or their nationality.
You mean the message of the film.
And, well, right. People that are born over time, if they get this some sort of facial difference, it could happen to anyone anywhere is my point. So,
right, I see.
So, you know, it's taboo, but at the same time, anybody can get bald palsy.
Exactly. Or cleft lip.
We know. So, yeah, so check it out. Go to Kickstarter and search either Don't Look Away. I got it that way. That time. And or you can search by Joseph Lengad, L-I-N-G-A-D, right. and consider kicking in some money and sign up. Go to the Facebook page, sign up, and keep in touch with this project as it moves towards fruition. And you come back on once it's done.
I would love to.
And we can talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. As I keep saying over the last few weeks, we've been doubling up on the episodes. We're going to continue to do it through the month. I I'm going to be at South by Southwest in a few days, and I don't know that I'll have the time to do it quite. We'll see. We're going to post a new show on Thursday, which I urge you to listen to if you're a big movie nut like we are. When I say we, me and my friends that come on the show regularly. One of which is Jeremy Workman. This is Jeremy's third time on the podcast, but he also has a film at South by Southwest, which he's premiering, called The World Before Your Feet, I think it's called. And it's a documentary, and we're going to have Jeremy back on again whilst at South by. So anyhow, I mention this because on the next episode, Jeremy and I will be joined by two other film geeks. One is Chico Leo, and the other is James Hancock. You may know these guys. They're big in the podcasting community. For instance, James has a wonderful podcast called Wrong Reel, which is like deep dives into different films and filmmakers and years of films. So if you love long, really immersive conversations in film, you'll want to go check out Wrong Reel as well. Anyway, the four of us are getting together. We already did. But the next episode is the four of us together talking about the career of Paul Schrader. And I hope it came out. I mean, in the sense that it's easy to follow. It's about an hour and a half. It'll be the next episode. And what we're trying to do is kind of position ourselves too, because I'd love to get Paul, who has a new film called First Reformed. He's coming out with a new movie in the next few weeks. So I thought, what good timing to do an episode about his career. So hopefully that will help. Anyway, so make sure to tune in to the next episode. Again, that'll be this Thursday. That's March the 8th. And then I'll be doing a bunch of stuff coming from Austin, Texas. And I've got a bunch of things lined up, some of which I'm very excited about. But I'm going to keep it a little on the DL for the moment. And when we get back, obviously, we'll be posting all that stuff. So thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode, which has been, by the way, episode number 466. The name of the show is Filmwax Radio. The name of the host is Adam Chartoff. Thank you. Take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Maybe you and I lay on mine. You can lose it all.
Thank you.